Okay, I think we're on.
Okay. I'm looking through your web page too, Barbara. I have your web page up, so it helps with references and projects and stuff I pull down.
So maybe we should say your name so that
your web page, yeah. Okay. Anyways.
So you should show your name so that transcriber.
Michael Meredith. What's the date today? I don't even know.
It's okay. It'll be on the file. Ashley Schaefer. Yeah, 60 degrees and sunny. Mm-hmm.
And Alejandro Aravena.
Okay. I guess just start with like kind of basic stuff and then we can do. When did you start your office? Maybe you can start with that. Or how did you start your practice? Like, what was your first? Were you doing projects? Competitions? Or did you start building right off?
I graduated in 92, then went to Italy to make as if I was studying in Venice. And in 94. And then I started my practice, doing mainly the typical type of work that you can get when you begin, an inoffensive word, like shops and restaurants and discos, and which because everybody knows they're going to disappear, so they're okay to hire a young architect, I guess, and it's a good for many reasons. I mean, because they want to show off, they ask you to do big gestures, so you very quickly take out of yourself all the stuff you wanted to prove while you were studying, so you empty yourself of the overacting kind of operations. Simultaneously, I was building the things with workers, and so you can realize very directly the mistakes you do while designing, or if you draw a form that on paper looks cool and inoffensive, then trying to build it, you suffer so much that you learn that you have to
think about that.
Choose better. Yeah. I mean, where you're going to spend your energy.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, it's fine. The bad part is, and then it tends to melt and disappear. So it's fine. There are no traces of that part of your life.
Have you hidden most of it, or do you think about it? Like, is there a discotheque still out there with your...
I think no. Everything is already destroyed, but naturally.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, I haven't been back, and but you get very shitty clients, and so actually
make a step up though? I assume like
because I quit architecture.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that I didn't study for that. I mean, if that was architecture, then I wasn't interested. So I quit. I ran a bar with a friend. So we got some money, and I was working in the bar, not doing architecture at all.
You designed the bar?
Yeah. Yeah. That went on for maybe a year. And then after a year, I decided I want to give what I studied a second chance. And I did the house for a sculpture for free with the condition that I could do whatever I want, which was... very stupid from my side because, well, first of all, I couldn't, and even if it was for free, I couldn't. She wanted to do things in a way, and then it's fair. I mean, it's their house. At least was an exercise where I was trying to be more accurate with the operations. I mean, now it's a more serious thing. It was with bricks, so it was a serious stuff. You know, and then immediately I was commissioned to do the mathematics faculty. So I went from almost nothing to an institutional building.
How did you get that?
I think I owe a lot to who was a professor of mine, Fernando Perez, and he was the dean at the time, and he suggested my name to the university to do the mathematics faculty, and on the other hand, it was a project that nobody wanted to do because you had to work over the summer and holidays were out of the question and the budget was very low. And but of course, when you're starting, you're okay with all that type of thing. So of course, I said, yeah, I'm okay. I mean, I'm doing this. And so I would say that my very first project was already an institutional project that allowed me to work with an indirect client, which I think is a very good thing. I mean,
I think one thing that's interesting is even the house, it seemed like they're at a scale that's almost institutional, let's say, like the size of the openings to the walls and things like this. They sort of seem even at the time when you're in a house,
yeah,
it's almost thinking of a bigger scale or something. I don't know, but I was wondering, do you think you have like you're still, let's say, young and very active and in growing as an architect and things like that, but do you feel like you have a style or something like this? Do you think you have a like a lot of times when you write and describe the projects, it's sort of like a search for language actually in your description. The problem of architectural language comes up again and again, and I was wondering if you think you have developed a language that's your own language, or does language develop from the place and the whatever, you know, things like this?
Yeah. Well, let me start by the question of the youth. I think it's in your comment about being young. My partner is an engineer. For architects, I'm 41. It's like we're only 40 young. You know, for an engineer, you're already 41. I mean, so what have we done? I mean, for engineers, it's normal. Okay, we're already 40. What have we done? They're already late. I think we architects are too much confident that you're young. I mean, depending where you are, in Italy, you're young until 50. I mean, sure. I think that's something very unhealthy for architecture. I mean, we shouldn't be treated as kids and given permission to experiment. And
sure.
I mean, we have a responsibility with a lot of money. The normal architecture is very expensive, even though even if you're doing social housing, it's a lot of money. So the question of young architects should be eliminated, absolutely. Young architects prize and emerging architects.
I think it takes time, though, to develop, let's say, because, say, experience in construction and going through it actually really is important, like you already said. You don't think there is something to say for, let's say, the more you build, the more experience you get, the more...
Take a look at construction size. When you're building a building, who is in the office with you building the building? Architects, constructor and builders that are in the late 20s, early 30s, I mean...
Sure.
And they go and handle a couple of tons of material, I mean, with confidence. I mean,
sure.
So other professions do not benefit from this kind of protection and bubble of on being kids for a long time.
Yeah. No, I'm not suggesting that saying adolescence, but I think there is something to say that, let's say, even if you look at a body of work from an architect, any architect that you admire, whoever, I want to talk about that too, like who are your sort of idols and things like this, but. It takes, even before the kind of institutional apparatus that's now, like education has delayed everything for all architects, that you don't really start even until you're 30, as opposed to other, like contracting, you don't need to go to school for so long, at least in the U.S. They don't really hit their stride even, for whatever reason, until they're maybe in their 40s or something like this, because it takes a long time to search for a language or search for a way of working or search for, you know, these sorts of issues come up, and maybe those days are over, maybe we don't believe in that anymore, but...
If you believe that architecture is art, yes, and that goes back to the other question about style. I don't think architecture is an art, I mean, and if it is, I don't care. I think style is like your handwriting or calligraphy. I can't help it. I mean,
if you give
me a piece of paper and I have to write down something, it comes out in a way. I mean, that's the way you write.
Sure.
But I'm more concentrated on the questions. The questions that have to be solved, that have if it's an equation, have many terms. I mean, many points of view.
I can't believe you. I mean, I love the way you present your work as like as almost a set of problems. Every project you present is like, this was the problem I solved. This was the problem I solved. This was the problem I solved. And you end up with something pretty extravagant in the end. I mean, most you may think it's a. I mean, there's a sort of economy to it, but like a Siamese tower or a building that's kind of cut in a certain way, I can't believe that that's not artful in a certain level. And
of course,
and not just about. It's not just you're not an engineer, and you're not. It's not all pragmatism. Let's say at the most base level, you may be interested in pragmatism and using pragmatic approach towards it, but there's something else at play. And usually, there's a really strong sense of actually even iconography in the work. I would say. Like, if you look at the shapes and the figures, there's a strong sense
of course, because in everything, even in science, there's a degree of freedom that in the end, always there's a degree of freedom. But the more freedom is there, the more constraints there are, the more hard, simple, direct information there is at the beginning, the more degrees of freedom you're going to find in the end. I'm not saying this is a... once you formulate the problem that you have to solve, that you have one single way out of it. What I'm saying is that it's healthy to make explicit what are you trying to achieve, so that then afterwards, while developing the project, you're very conscious about which direction you are going to have to take. I mean, designing is always a question of choice. I mean, it's a forking path kind of sequence of things, and there's people that choose better than other. I'm just trying to be sure that while choosing for this path or that other path, I'm fulfilling more than less of the terms that I was asked to do at the beginning. There are very simple questions at the beginning from the client, like square meters, I have this amount of money, I want this program.
I have
this
service.
And then this is the client. That doesn't mean that that's the problem they have to solve. This is part of the question. Then you have the regulation on the costs. And
do you think that like you get clients now because they say this guy's really good at solving problems, he's really good with the budget?
Part of
or
them.
Or do you get them because they say, wow, they produces amazing spaces?
I would say half and half. an institution doesn't care about the wow. I mean...
Why would they pick you over any other architect? Because you think like just like a normal, let's say, not you're in an academic kind of setting. You're an academic still at a certain level. You're involved in kind of a very rarefied atmosphere of architecture, and you think they would come to you just because they think you are great as a service provider in a way?
Well, I have to compete to get the job first as a service provider.
Yeah.
I mean. To differentiate yourselves, maybe the final decision is based on other types of things. But the beginning, you start in a request for qualifications, you start in a, applying to something, and there you have to, if you don't have this and that amount of square meters, then you are out of the question. If you can't prove that you solve other similar problems, then you're out of the question. So at the beginning, you're competing with very simple things against others. Maybe the final distinction is done. Based on different issues. But coming back to the way project is started, there's a need and that needs to be satisfied. Square meters, program and budget, local regulations, and that are very explicit and objective data. That doesn't mean that the question is already complete with all that information. You have to be you're a creator, let's say, in raising the question. Nobody will ask you to answer to the weather, let's say, I mean, or to the orientation, or to the relation with the neighbors, or to the situations you are creating. Let's say, if you go into any program, you have to ask yourself, okay, what is in the end a learning community, a university, or what is the problem of a dormitory, or what is the problem of having computers? I mean, every project has like embedded a set of questions that you have to come up with and make it, at least ask. We want to make it explicit so that we can verify if we're doing better or worse while developing the project. I mean, architecture takes such a long time that, I mean, you have to agree with yourself for a year at least, from when you start, then when you're start design, then when you start construction.
Do you think that most, I mean, for me it seems like what you're talking about seems very basic actually though, in a certain level too. It's like, do you think most architects don't do that already in a certain level? Because I feel like that's probably the base, that's a base condition for most architects who are practicing.
Maybe. Maybe. I don't know. So, because I'm not trying to understand why I'm different. Yeah. I'm just explaining what I do.
I'm trying to understand why you're different. That's why I'm
But I'm not interested. I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Maybe.
But you would say that you would, instead of those, I would think you would argue, at least the way you even present yourself in the product descriptions, assuming you wrote these things, is that there, one is an extreme pragmatism almost, which I think is interesting. And then the other hand, there's not too many I'm sorry if I come back to it, but youngish architects that I would say use the sketch as much as you do also when presenting their work. I think there's something interesting about that kind of split, because I would say this: you sketch more than, at least you present your sketches as part of the project.
Because I don't know how to draw in computers. I tried to learn in maybe 2000 and something, and I couldn't. So.
But you know, I was just thinking about what you said about the calligraphy. I thought that was interesting, because when you were saying that, I was thinking, that made me think, oh yeah, actually you do calligraphy, or whatever, you draw
a lot.
With your hand a lot more than most, I would say. And I don't know if that's a different thing than thinking about, even the way your type of drawings are, they're more like, let's say, I would say, like a Cisa or something, or, which I would assume is somebody you would appreciate. I don't know, when I look at the sketches, I get that sense that you do. And they're much more about, let's say, an embodied experience than even a pragmatic problem solving. Like, you're not, at least the ones I've seen, the sketches, maybe, I'm sure there's ones where you're just working out a corner detail and things like this. But they're much looser and much more about space and the kind of visceral quality.
Because the sketches that I might have shown are the very initial ones where you're just trying to understand what you would like to do. But then I would say 80% of the sketches that I do are to try to visualize problems. I mean, that's the only, I don't do a sketch, let's say, for detailing the corner, but trying to understand the problem of the corner so that then somebody that knows how to do it can detail it.
Yeah.
And I sketch because if I could do it in the computer and was faster, maybe I would do it that way. Until now, I was unable to learn that. I mean, I arrived late to the generation that was trained with computers.
Yeah, I like this about you. I mean, this is one thing I like, is you're sort of an old-fashioned architect. And I think you are sensitive to this. Even when you talk about your references here, it's like you talk about Louis Kahn, who I love personally. But like Louis Kahn... I can't remember the art you should bring up. I don't hear any references of like Olamé or Herzog and de Meuron or whatever really contemporary figures. You're always referencing, let's say, like a kind of like modernism of sorts. And I'm curious about that. Like, who do you see yourself? Who are the people that you're in dialogue with? Are they these people? Do you see yourself in dialogue with sort of contemporary figures as well? I don't know. Like, when you're thinking about the world of architecture, and this will bring to another question probably even about your role in the Pritzker, because you have to have I would imagine you'd produce a survey of architecture that you're operating within. It would be hard not to be self-conscious given your status of things.
Yeah, well, I think this dialogue is, I try to have it with as many people as possible. It just doesn't work in a single direction. I mean, the ones that you admire, that you would like to be like. I would say that most of the work I look at is to know what not to do. There are paths that closes because it's already done. And not because that doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's already done, so that means that the particular answer for the question already found its optimum there. If I have a different problem, I should look at the approach this guy had, but very unlikely I'm going to be able to produce an optimum if the set of parameters of the question is different. So, but I have to filter a lot what we look at for many reasons. First of all, I'm getting more work outside Chile, but for a long time I was working in Chile. And one of the reasons you look a lot at stuff is to be comfortable with what you're not doing. I mean, it's very sad when in the corner of the world you try to do the same thing that is produced in the center, you know, and then you say, look, I can do what you do here as well. So
do you think when you operate, like, let's say, outside of Chile, it would be different? The work would be radically different? Or do you think that the stuff you did in Chile would kind of carry you to other parts of the world?
Well, until now, I haven't found one single case where the problems are not the same like in Chile. We have been cutting costs in every single project that we have been doing outside Chile the same way we did in Chile.
But construction labor, I mean, come on, there's a totally different labor, I would imagine, in the U.S.,
well, yes and no. We were talking on the car about the Mexican labor in Texas. I mean, and that's very
Texas
close.
Is, yeah, sure.
But then wherever you move, in the end, but wherever you move, in the end, you will find that the guys hands-on are the guys that are more or less the ones like you. I mean, you know, guys that are the poorest in a social scale that work on construction because they don't know anything.
But there's got to be different things. Like, for instance, a lot of the work has a masonry in it. And some people would have gotten arguments with other faculty even about the... as a proponent of masonry construction in school, who thought it was unethical because that's not how... Labor doesn't work like that in the U.S. anymore. They don't deal with unit-based construction at that level. They're much larger units and panelized things. So I would say, and even that it's perhaps even unsustainable in places which are more of a timber-based kind of construction and some whatever, if you're in the Northeast. But so I would imagine there would be some... There are differences, ultimately. There's still like localized politics, even, or localized trades that become... that are different in different places. I don't know. I'm curious about that. I mean, I love the kind of... The one thing that seems clear from your... the project in Texas you're talking about is there's a kind of rough materiality to it that's carried across and it's played up, even. I mean, you're very conscious of it, obviously, when you do certain things on a certain, on the walls and things like this.
Yeah, well, I would say that I'm not good in mathematics. I mean... Or reasonably good. I mean, as we all have to be as architects. But I'm not particularly good in calculating and stuff like that. But I do remember that when I was at school and at the university, if there was an equation, mathematicians would say that there are ways to solve the equation that are more elegant than others.
Yeah.
And that meant that if you are able to make a shortcut to find the solution. Maybe the solution is more simple.
Yeah.
Even though there might be more than one answer, there are some that are more elegant than others.
Yeah.
I connect that to the name of half of my practice, which is elemental.
Yeah.
You know, elemental, it's something, an elementary project. It's something that you would like to do no matter how much money you've got. I mean... Try to answer with what is strictly necessary.
Yeah.
Make, you know, the most direct path from A to B. Try to reduce and try to... No, it's not reduce because it's that's leaving things out that it might be necessary. Try to synthesize your answer so that there's more specific weight in what you're doing. That approach in Chile is not a choice. Being trained under scarcity of means, I mean, either you do that way, or you are, you know, an exception of the rule. And I'm very happy of being trained in that under scarcity of means because there was a match between the programs we were trying to do at Elemental, and then an attitude that once you go out to Germany, for example, for the Vitro, now that I'm going to do a winery in Germany, or even the Texas project. That same elementary approach, I mean, okay, with all the terms of the equation, try to solve it in the most synthetic way. Because I think in the end it's more efficient, it makes more sense. I mean, I can't explain why. I just think I prefer to do it that way.
Yeah.
And so even though the language or the roughness would be perceived as a style, I'm more concentrated on the approach.
It's a style. I mean, I'm not really saying it's a style. I mean, maybe it is, but it's just a consistent thing that reappears. I don't even know if that's a style. Maybe more, even more deep than a style.
Yeah, you know, in the book that was published in Italy, in Electa, on the cover there's an equation. I don't know if you've seen that.
Here it's a new book, right? Is this one?
Could be. I don't know if it's a link or something.
Yeah, I like your webpage.
Simple. Well, the book, is there a book?
No. It's coming. My wireless is like, here it is.
Okay.
Yes, cloud over chair equals X over architecture.
Yeah, the thing that's not a cloud is a kind of belt. It's a piece of cloth. Which is, there's a...
formlessness or something, or what is it?
I don't know if I have one of those chairs in my bag. It might be in the hotel. you know, there's a... the question is the following. Do you have a piece of paper that I can form a napkin?
It's the chair. It's the chair that the natives use, right? It's
I tried to explain that approach to design using the example of the chair. I mean, if we're asked to design a chair, this is a typical simple design that we come up with. You know, four legs, then something to sit, and then the back. But then I saw this Indian from Paraguay. That is, you know, this guy is sitting with a piece of cloth wrapping around the back and the legs, you know, doing the force of that you normally do with the arms when you sit like this. So there's a piece of cloth. And when I saw that, I thought that, well, if I thought that this was the most simple chair, well, this is far beyond that. Mm-hmm. And that piece of cloth has at least three things that we can learn from. First one, the Indian in Paraguay cannot afford anything but a piece of cloth as a chair. Mm-hmm. So to know how to design under scarcity of means is relevant. So that's one thing. Second, even if this man had more money, other type of chair doesn't make any sense because he's a nomad. So he has to be able to carry his chair. He doesn't eventually even have pants, you know, like hang it like here. Finally, this represents a kind of ultimate limit for this design. You cannot keep on taking things out because instead of the noun chair, what remains is the pure verb, to sit.
Yeah.
So this design is irreducible. So I said that, well, the chair is to the belt as X is to architecture. Yeah. So what we're trying to do...
So
X is relevant... It's precise and irreducible. So I always try to go for the belt.
Yeah.
And that no matter where you're building and how many resources you've got or the question, it is an attitude that I would say I would... I'm very consciously trying to follow that in every single project I do.
I like that. I like it when you say it, but I look at the work and I think... The absolute, like, if you look at the project in Texas, which I think is a very beautiful project, I would say, well, then why do you need these chamfered corners and the pitch roof to reappear?
Because part of the equation is a facilities committee saying that they would like a neo-Gothic campus. So part of the equation is a very subjective aspiration for decoration, old forms and everything. And in this case... If you take a look at
this, is a for me the argument though in that is far more, and maybe I'm misreading it for me, but when you talk about the chair, it's much more of a an objective thing, because subjectively you could say
of course we're talking about the chair,
yeah.
But a building is a much more complex problem than a chair. A city is a much more complex.
Yeah.
When you deal with communities, with preferences, with taste, I mean, we can make if it doesn't exist. Or we can accept that that is going to be there, even if you can't express and formulate it explicitly.
Yeah.
It does belong with what we have to deal with.
Sure.
And for many years, modern architecture did as if it didn't. I mean, but then there's a natural reaction.
There's a cultural thing there in modernism, right? It was also modernism was embraced by, let's say, scientists, was embraced culturally at a greater level as really an interesting, provocative cultural idea, much larger. And I think now that doesn't exist. People aren't interested in that. They're much more interested in the neo-Gothic, I guess, of campus.
Yeah. So I said, okay, I'm not going to escape what you're raising as a question, but let's try to debate. And this took a long time. Let's try to concentrate on what you're looking for, because the forms that you're looking at is the way you're trying to achieve something. But let's talk about that something. I mean, what is that? So there was a question of integrating the building into an existing language that had to do with foreign proportion, out, you know, that were far away from the box. And I'm sorry, I mean, this is very concrete. I mean, they didn't want 90 degrees angles. I mean, just for saying that.
They didn't want 90 degrees. They didn't want on the roof.
Yeah, I mean, they wanted a pitch roof.
Yeah.
Pitch roof, for me, was unnecessary. There were technical reasons why it didn't make any sense.
Sure.
But, so, how we came out with this thing, if you take a look at the, well, you can't hear, but the previous versions of the project, in plan, it was something like this. And then I have a form that was meandering through space.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why the form was meandering is because on the perimeter of the building, we had the rooms, and we had too many rooms to accommodate, to which we wanted to give views to the outside and light, and direct views and direct light. So we had to articulate the perimeter to have a longer line, more linear meters of rooms, let's say, towards the outside. But this was straight, let's say, the perimeter of the footprint. We got so many meetings to cut costs that in the end, this was a double-loaded corridor over here, that instead of doing this, the diagonal of this thing uses less bricks.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take a look at the form of this, we're taking out the square meters of corridor that is not needed over here, then we have another form going over there. So all the corners in plan began to be chamfered because the diagonal uses less bricks than the 90 degree angle. And then if you go to the section, we tend to have stairs here or shafts. So when you arrive up, again, the stair goes along like this, then you have the change in direction. So the building here expresses the fact that I can't take out the air above the part of the stair that already went down. And again, compared to this, these were less bricks. And the problem with the cost was we were counting brick by brick in the end to be able to not sacrifice other parts of the project that were valuable to us.
But would you get upset, let's say, if I said that seemed very content, like your argument may be very mathematical even, let's say, like your equation. But if I said, you know what, I could think about this project, and I could think about Chipperfield's, I could think about other projects that are being going on. Does that bother you, or do you think that's a failure of the equation, or do you think that's just inevitable?
We did a project for a touristic viewer or something in Mexico, and came up with a form that we liked.
Yeah.
A couple of months afterwards, we saw a house on a cliff in Portugal done by somebody who was exactly the same.
Yeah.
So I guess there are some problems where you have
does
more
that, does that bother you when you saw it, or did you go, it's just totally different?
Not different. I'm actually, I think we had similar problems. Yeah. I mean, if you're doing housing, when you have upper parts that can go away from the wall and become a roof, which is something close to what typically has been experimenting in Madrid, for example, because of the regulation on the code and everything, sometimes that expresses that problems are not that different. Mm-hmm.
So you think the problems are driving, like, for instance, in these cases, considering...
They might be similar. I don't know exactly. Yeah. I just know...
So the architect project. Is kind of, when they follow problems, let's say, their forms may be similar to other forms, and that's normal. That's just...
I think it's natural. Yeah. I mean...
What? I had a question about, like, sort of went off on.
Can I sense just the reason that you two are paired is exactly, and you fell into my trap perfectly. You've already said architecture is not an art. And Michael, your practice is definitely, I think, you would even say that you sort of dabble in the art world. No?
I don't know if I dabble, but I'm friends with artists and I like art. But I don't think art is so whimsical, maybe. In a certain level, I would say art is actually operates not much differently than even like at least the artists I like, maybe even from the way that Alejandro is talking about architecture. I mean, I don't think it's just people. I think they're thinking about it and they're thinking about the problems. Let's say the problems maybe are material problems in some certain cases or things like this. I don't think it's just somehow there's some naive illusion that art is some purely free, libidinal thing. It's actually much more, I think, there's a lot of technical constraints, a lot of problems to be solved and things like this. But I do think architecture, I am interested in architecture, let's say, as an art and not a service. So that's...
I wanted you to debate this.
Yeah, I'm happy to debate this. I think the service is a given, almost. We do buildings, we're not as big as your buildings, but I would say... we understand that there's clients and you have to meet the clients. And I feel I get tortured at night thinking, am I burdening this poor person's life with this kind of thing, you know? Like anybody else, like they're going to every day have to look at this thing that we make and is this a headache for them or not? And, but I think that's almost the given. I think that's a base condition. I don't think it's for me, I'm not interested in a history of architecture that's based on how well they solve the problems. I'm interested in, let's say, a history of architecture which talks about it within a cultural context, which talks about it, maybe even style will come up as an issue, but also its relationship to other things outside of itself, including the arts, including science, math, etc., things like this. I'm more interested in that kind of idea of architecture. So the thought of it being, and I don't think you believe it, I actually think it's almost... I mean, I think you do believe it, but you're interested in the pragmatic and even the this kind of radical sense of economy that you're talking about. But I think you're using it to try to get somewhere else. And I don't think that somewhere else is more interesting to me.
Because I think part of the problems we're solving are cultural. Yeah. And there you go into a more boundary-less realm. But still... are problems that we need to resolve. I would say that the if there's any difference or why I don't think it's an art, or at least I'm not interested in the artistic approach, by that I mean where you start from. I mean, I would say that there are enough problems out there so that we don't have to start from problems we want to solve. I mean, I do have tools to achieve some things. There are problems that some communities, people, institutions have. There are problems inherent to the question that need to be solved. Mm-hmm. And with that, I think that's it's more than enough. I mean, to add to it a personal agenda.
I don't think
personal,
it's personal. I think that there's other problems that are cultural. Like, I think architecture is a whole... I mean, you teach history theory, for God's sakes, man. I mean, I think, like, you would think that architecture has a whole series of cultural and interesting cultural problems that are a different constituency than even the people living in the buildings that are a broader disciplinary, let's say, set of values and ideas that change, and that people can talk about it. You can look at your building and compare it to another building done in time, and you can start to look at, build up a taxonomy of kind of ideas or how things evolve and tie into culture and talk about composition. You could talk about, you know, you could talk about things like this, which may not be of interest, but they do exist in a kind of when you're talking amongst other.
Yeah, but what I used to teach, and which I wrote in the books, where, okay, what can we learn from these buildings? Because this guy had the problem to have the blank page in front of them as we do. So why don't we make a shortcut and try to learn from the way they did? I'm not interested in the ideas, let's say, on the problems that we add to.
You mean,
endogamic set of. Dialogue. I mean, there's an endogamy in the dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, somebody did this regarding space, so I'm going to comment on that and keep on doing. I mean, I'm not interested in that sequence of problems that interest only others within the architectural discipline.
Yeah.
I'm out of that set of problems. I mean, we have enough with the problems that are out there, and I do have a knowledge regarding the use, strategic use of form that can solve those problems that are already out there.
I don't
want to add my own problems.
I think you do, regardless.
But again, it's like handwriting. I mean, you do it, and you can't help it. I mean,
I think you're so unselfconscious or so naive. I mean, or whatever, innocent. Let's say. I think you must be aware. Like when I look at your facades or something, I could say there's a very interesting compositional sort of set of games usually going on, which have to do with patterning, which have to do with displacing grids or something like this, or some other way of thinking about composition.
Yeah.
You're not thinking about all the windows necessarily lined up as punched windows. You're thinking about some other wrapper almost.
That expresses that we there touch a degree of freedom, because once you solve all the problems, there's always a degree of freedom, and if you want to do it one way or another, then your handwriting operates, I would say. This aligning the window has many ways to be explained pragmatically again. So if I have to choose...
You choose a pragmatic explanation.
It's a combination of a pragmatic explanation, what looks better. I mean, there are some things that look better than others.
Yeah.
And that belongs to the part of architecture that cannot be, or at least I don't want to explain. It belongs to the, as Wittgenstein, it belongs to the part of the world that you better remain silent about.
I would say Wittgenstein, though, but towards the end, at least, would have said that, you know, what interests him in language is the social construction of it, and not so much in its absolute, so that social construction is actually the really interesting thing.
But since this alignment of the window does belong to the part that we better remain silent about,
you're talking about like the first Wittgenstein. I think the second Wittgenstein is better.
I'm not a Wittgenstein scholar.
Yeah.
I mean, I brought it up because there's a sentence of him that has oriented my work, which is, there are things that you can talk about and that can be talked about very clearly. And the ones
you pass over in silence. Yeah, that's the.
And the ones it's silence. And the thing is that since that part, like the disaligning windows, belong to the part that I better don't talk about, it's not a discourse, and it's never shared with the ones that.
I think this is a great divide, actually, in a way, because I think, you know, if you look at, and not that it matters, but if you look at Wittgenstein and you look at first Wittgenstein, when he says we can't talk about, we must pass over in silence. He disappears for whatever, so many years, goes off, works as a carpenter or something.
Gardener,
yeah. And then he comes back and in philosophical investigations and refutes all that early work, because he says that actually, you know, what's interesting is that language is not this, opaque thing that the thing that's interesting about it is not that we can't talk about it, we have to pass on silence, is that we can talk about it, even though it's ephemeral and we can't really quite grasp it, is that it's a socially constructed thing. And yet the act of talking about it and the act of actually thinking about it is probably one of the most interesting parts of language, let's say. It's not its objective quality, but it's more social, let's say, engagement. And so I think I'm more interested in the second part of that Wittgenstein thing. And there's people, I mean, I only, like, people like,
yeah,
we talk about this a lot, like,
well,
game cluster, all that sort of things like
if,
this. People
if,
are like,
if we keep on trying to use that triangle as a way of explaining this, there's, we're talking about the part I do. There's a complete other part in the projects that I do that is a social conversation, and actually it's not done by me. It's a social conversation done with Thal, and all the Lehman Thal work has a complete different way of explanation. And I do believe architecture, and actually if you take a look at the buildings, half of it, if we're splitting the things in halves, half of it is done by me, and we can apply all the kind of conversation we had, the other half.
Yeah.
It's a social conversation that I don't expect to control. I just give some frames, physical frames, for that to happen. But I'm more than happy than the buildings are a start for something that will end up in a social contract.
Yeah. So there's no, I mean, the, that, for me, the thing that would be is interesting is, in a way, the kind of, when you're talking, almost the desire or the lack of self-consciousness, almost in a certain way, like that you're, when you look at this thing, like it doesn't, you're not looking at this thing thinking about, looking at architecture, thinking about it as a set of images even, or something like this, but more as a set of problems to be solved. I think that's interesting. The thing that
I mean, I'm very
the work is very much images, though. I mean, like when I look at it, it's so iconographic. Like your facades are really probably your most the things that you show the most, or something like this, or the figures of the buildings. Let's say the figure. The figure seems like one of the most interesting aspects of your work, and you're very interested in figuration, I think. Yet, you would argue that that's just a result of problems that need to be solved. When I would say it's actually not, I would say you're interested. There's a desire, for whatever reason, to think about figuration. And
but
figuration has a whole history of problems that are really interesting.
The thing is, whose desire is that? I mean, it's not my desire to articulate the figure. It's somebody don't wanting a box that says, you know, I'm tired of the boxy, you know, cool architecture. I would like something that is closer to what I like. And that might, in one case, has chamfers, in another case, has a way to cut against the sky, which is this and that. So, the question of
figurativeness... Do your clients really know that well? I mean, like, I feel like you go into these projects and
they
clients
don't know.
No. You actually talk to
them. Tell you very clearly, you know, I don't want a modern, boxy building.
Sure, something like this.
Or your clients want, like in Texas, you told me on the way here, your clients are pleased that it's getting good reviews, right?
They yes,
want
exactly.
They want that media. Is going to distinguish
But at the beginning, they just knew that they didn't want modern architecture. That meaning by that, 90 degree boxy, glossy, you know.
But the inside, let's say, of that building that is the most modern red glass, I mean, it's like, it's ultra modern almost in a way. So I would say.
Yeah, but isn't that natural? I mean, in everybody, like in everybody's house, I mean, your living room, I mean, the exterior, what you want to show to the visits is, okay, this is engaging the campus, and we're okay. Then inside in your bedroom, who knows what you're doing? I mean, I don't care. Do your architecture inside. I'm fine. I mean, and
yeah,
actually...
The clients would say, yeah.
Yeah, and actually, if you take a look, it might have a lot of variety in the pattern, but the form is the most straight one because, again, the corridor can't meander throughout the space. I mean, it's the best direct possible corridor inside.
We should talk about another project. I feel like we're talking about that project too much. But the
and I think a couple of the questions.
Yeah, what are the questions? Sorry.
I mean, you were actually on the who are your idols or people.
Yes,
we were converging on that, and I think that's a good. You started to sort of answer that question by saying you there were people that you.
Didn't want
to not be like, but I think the question is, well, go ahead and ask it, Michael.
I think that's an important question to think about. Who do you think you're in conversation with, even historically or something like this. And it may be that you're not interested in that question even, which is what you've been saying.
I'm very interested in that question. But I would say that that conversation is an indirect one. Of course, I do think there are many architects today that you know, the question of reference, it's a mixture between envy, you know, this guy already did, you know, this thing is fantastic. I wish I came up with the idea first. I mean, that type
of...
It could
be disrespect, too, though. I think it could be disrespect, or something. I mean, I think it's just... You know,
I normally envy the people that do a good job.
Yes,
simultaneously, I feel that I'm not alone in the amount of energy and effort that requires to produce quality. So, you have mixed feelings, okay, envying... you know, good architects, and at the same time, knowing that you're not alone in the pursuit. In the amount of in the pursuit of that achieving that quality. And I could give you a couple of contemporary names. I don't have problems with that. And for example, I think Caesar is a great architect. Herzog de Meuron, I think they're fantastic architects, and. Peter Merkley in Switzerland is a fantastic architect, and I can name maybe 20. Smiljan Radic, I think, and it's a fantastic architect from Chile. And there are a couple of architects in South America that don't just admire, but also are very close as and have actually influence or in the way one changes paths what one is producing, like Bucci in Brazil or Benitez in Paraguay or Iglesias in Argentina. But that's architecturally speaking. I feel it's more connected to other disciplines. I mean, I was very much impressed with the biography of Ayrton Senna, for example, the Formula One driver.
Yeah. That's cool. I don't know.
The guy was a genius in his own field, and I do learn. Reading the biography, the way he was riding a car. I learned a lot from that and tried to apply to my own way to produce quality. I'm interested in perfectioning the tools I use to achieve quality. And so my references.
So the car. I want to know about the guy in the car. I think so. The Formula One driver. What was it when you said you were reading and you learned from it? Is it that the kind of relationship of the person and the tool gets so close and tight that they're almost indistinguishable? Is that what it is?
Two very specific lessons that I learned while I was reading the biography. One, this guy had a way to adjust the car before any race that was even more accurate than the machines and computers.
Sure.
You know,
it's like if you could focus a camera better than auto focus.
And for example, he would tell the mechanics that there was a problem with the engine somewhere. So he asked the team to dismantle the car. And say, "What, are you crazy? I mean, take a look at the computers we have on the car. No one single sign that the car is going wrong. Well, you know, I listened to that in curve number whatever, and something's not working." Of course, it was a very convincing guy. Mechanics dismantled the car and found the piece that is not working properly. I mean, that not even computers were registering it, but he could hear the sound of the engine not doing the right noise. I mean, that level of precision in the tools you need to achieve a high level performance is something I'm very much interested. I mean, to try to adjust the way a team operates, what the materials we're using. I mean, how do we relate with you know what I mean? I mean, if I translate it to my own practice, I think it's fascinating to be able to trust your intuition for quality, and even though if you go to a construction site and you look at something, you know, this is not aligned. I mean, I'm okay with mistakes.
Yeah.
So I'm not talking about perfection in construction. Yeah, sure. I'm talking about something is not going well here. You know?
Methodology or something.
Yeah, or the way you're going, if you keep on doing like this, you're going to find the problem when you arrive to a roof. Yeah. That type of thing. That's something that really really amazed me in the biography. The other thing is that this guy was, of course, a genius in what he was doing. And one of the things is that the level of concentration in the race was not just... I mean, what's something that we all know that we're... I mean, I'm not even a car person. I mean, I'm not interested in cars at all. But this particular thing, we all know...
You must be that somewhat interested to read the biography, though. Or
but Ayrton Senna, the Brazilian Formula One car driver...
I don't know
who he is, but...
He died in an accident.
Yeah.
That
seems like a sad.
Yeah,
that actually sort of.
And that
a very different kind of take on it.
And you know, because he was adjusting the car, the length of the wheel, and the mechanics didn't do the way he did, and apparently, and this is a big discussion ongoing today, that when he had to make the curve, it broke. So actually, when he died, because he crashed against a wall, there are no signs of brakes. That means that he was turning and that broke because it was not done the way
he wanted.
Yeah.
Someone's to blame on the team.
Yeah, I mean, and it's
horrible.
Yeah, no, but I think it arrives to that limit. I mean, but what I wanted to say is that we all know that in Formula One, it is so fast that you're running, you know, 1,000 feet ahead of where you are, you know, because it will arrive in a second. I mean, so you're not driving with your eyes, you're driving with your mind. That's why you know what's the next curve, you know, in the next 2 seconds, that you can't see the next 2 seconds. I mean, but this particular guy, friends tell that his level of concentration during the race was that he was running his race, but a couple of other racers' race as well. I mean, in his head, he had the trajectories.
These are like sports in a way. People, do you think that you're like running a race when you're doing the building? Is it like a sporting event or something? Is it a
I would
like
say
a
that
competition?
It, no, I would say that a project. Yeah. Is a situation in which you're measured at the maximum level of your capacities, like in sport. I mean, you're within a set of rules, within a given field, within a time frame, whatever it is. It could be a sport with ball or, you know, like a race. You have a set of rules for a moment in time, and within that, you're measured how well can you do that. And
who sets these rules? The client, the economy,
the problem itself. I mean, and we've been talking about the set of rules, and it comes from the client, from the regulation, from the weather, from the climate, from materials, from taste.
I made some coffee. Sorry, I thought there was coffee.
I thought you were making coffee.
I wasn't. We had coffee this morning, and I think I'm sorry. I just want a little caffeine because I think we need to get a little more energy in the coffee.
More energy.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. It's good. I love it. I still am...
But again, so if I go back, I was trying to finish the idea. He was, in his mind, not just running his own race, but other guys' race as well. Because I actually...
Peter Eisner talking about chess, though, or something. You know what I mean? It's like you're going to be like one step ahead of everybody. You know, that's what that way he would talk about architecture.
But I'm not talking about other architects in this case. I mean, the parallel would be I'm talking about the construction of a building. I mean, in a building, there's so many things that you have to pay attention to that you can't do just the architect's part. I mean, you have to run simultaneously the race of the builder, the race of the client, the race of the user, of the politician, if it's the case, or the... So, I would say that to be able to have in your head all the possible races that are being run.
I would
run.
Say something lives instead of races. But yeah, sure, I could see subjects or something.
Yes. Yeah. And so that way of perfecting the tools you use to achieve quality is something that I learned, or I wish that was illuminated by this Formula One race driver.
How could you though think about? I mean, I know this is maybe this is the problem of architecture, but how could you think about all the let's say a building and a race are different in the sense that there's probably more limited variables in the race. Architecture, the variables of if we even put it in equations like this or terms that you're thinking of, are much more open-ended and not
absolutely
discrete. So like you, how would you be thinking about there's. I mean, I would imagine there's going to be limits to this. Do you think of how can you think about every subject of your building, you know, in a way? Every, or do you think about those that are the ones paying for it versus the ones that are acting within it or something like this or coming to it? I mean, do you have a hierarchy of subjects?
When I talk about equations, I'm not interested in saying that there's going to be one single answer out of it, yeah. But I'm saying that let's try to be as explicit as possible with how many entrances this thing had. If this was a rope, let's understand how many fibers composed the rope. And I'm trying to identify as many fibers as possible. Because otherwise, I mean, it doesn't mean that in the end, because no project is perfect, and actually many of the projects are criticism and you fail to fulfill this or that, but at least it was not that I wasn't aware of it. I mean, I just... Sometimes you can't solve every single problem of the project. But that doesn't mean that, well, you know, I wish I knew that. I mean, well, we saw it and we couldn't make it. I mean, but we were trying very explicitly not to leave things outside
Do you think that, in a way, what your practice is in a sense, a reaction against the avant-garde? Or something like this of architecture, architectural avant-garde from the 70s and 80s, perhaps even?
No, well, again...
Would you see it like that, or no? Because it seems like when you present it, it would be almost diametrically opposed to, let's say, the practices of the architect, what I would, you know, from the architectural avant-garde from the late 60s till, which has basically been sort of filtering down, from, or petering out for a while now. But,
I would say it's just a reaction to experience that we were out of important discussions in my country. I mean, if you want to sit on the table with the Ministry of Housing, if you want to sit on the table with the Ministry of Public Works and have a say in the city, if you don't change the way... I mean, at the time, I'm talking about 2000, to be able to sit on the table, I mean, the Minister of Housing was a lawyer. And then, you know, everybody else deciding housing policy was an engineer. And I was an architect, not having an idea what a subsidy was. It was so embarrassing that I couldn't engage the language through which the city is being produced. That I can say, you know, you all have no idea what you're talking about. Let's go study architecture and or urbanism and then meet back. Or I say, this is my problem. I'm not being able to understand the legal aspect of the problem, the economic aspect, the financial aspect, the social aspect. So I thought I had to react to that because I didn't have all the languages that I needed.
Do you think education is totally flawed then? Education should change, like the way that architecture is taught.
I would say if I have to choose, it's one very specific thing that we don't find in architecture schools today, which is to learn how to work with constraints and restrictions. I mean, that is the only common language, because there's a lot of debate like saying, you know, we architects do not know about reality. Let's go into the reality. I think academia should keep a distance from reality, otherwise you're not going to be able to, you know, to jump from what is already being produced. But it shouldn't be that far away that in what you are trained, once you go into the real world, you don't have the tools appropriate for that. And the thing I think we're missing, and I'm going to tell you a very specific story about that, is constraints and restriction. My partner in Elemental is a transport engineer, is Andres Giacobelli. I met him at Harvard. He was doing his master's in public policy and the School of Government. when we went back to Chile to try to do something with social housing, he was invited to as a professor at the School of Architecture, even though he had no idea what architecture is about. And he was invited to a studio where they were doing reviews. They were doing public schools in the periphery for the poor. I mean, from the title, you would say, fantastic. I mean, these guys are trying to engage reality.
Yeah, sure.
So he went into the review, took a look at the project, and said, did you talk to any school administrator or to the guys that put together money to run a school, because it's subsidized and actually it's a private business, let's say in Chile, to run public schools. Did you go and talk to them? I said, no, but we made a very deep research in what educational trends are today, what is good for our educational standards and so on and so forth. So they, and the studio, became experts in education. And the conclusion of their expertise was that 8 square meters per student was needed to create the appropriate environment. And so my partner says, yeah, well, you know what? With public money, you can pay for 4 square meters in public schools. That means that these guys were trained to do great schools, but they needed 8 square meters. Reality has to work with 4. If we don't accept that constraint and that restriction, we are not going to be trained to give form under those conditions, which in the end are the ones that alienate us. I mean, we have to change the world to be able to operate. And meanwhile, the world is being built. So that's what I think needs to be radically changed, which is not that much. I mean, just include more data in the initial problem and keep it to the end. What we did at Harvard, they said, we have $7,000 for a unit, it means 30 square meters. Yeah, you know what, but people need more meters. Sorry, we have money with public funds for 30 square meters. If we don't do something with that, and we think that the ideal and the if it's not dignifying the people, then somebody else will bid 100,000 units per year anyway.
Do you want sugar or milk? I don't know if I have I have a question to follow up on what you were saying. Is if let's say everybody does what you suggest, does the world look different?
Sorry, again?
Everybody follows what you're saying. They say we need to listen more and follow and work within constraints. Do you think the world would look different?
At least I would say we wouldn't. This is how I say it. There's an extremely powerful tool that we architects have and deal with and are trained for, which is a synthetic tool, which is the project. Complex problems tend to have these many fibers. I mean, if you sit in a table, like for housing policy or for this type of things that I've been involved lately, I mean, you'll find brilliant guys saying something about financing, about, you know, the legal structure of how to give subsidies, or, you know, how to deal with communities and participatory design, new trends, and so on and so forth. But somebody, once you understood the complexity of the problem, somebody has, okay, so how do we move forward? We architects have the project, which is a very synthetic tool. If we're not within that conversation, what the world is missing is a synthetic tool. Somebody has to synthesize.
Yeah.
The problem is that architecture, I guess, has the capacity of having multi-channels of entrance to the problem. If engineers do, they do have a synthetic tool as well, because they do projects, actually they draw, but they do one thing at a time. Take a look at highways, for example.
Sure.
They perform in one direction, a plane, it's for flying. I mean, if you introduce more complexity to the problem, they tend to have more problems to synthesize. So I would say that if we learn how to operate with constraints and do accept that the question will start from outside of ourselves and it's going to be verified outside architecture, then the problem will have a synthetic tool on the table to be able to operate. So I don't know if it's going to change or not. The problems are going to be the same, the constraints the same, and eventually, but we're going to have a tool that is more efficient to move forward, maintaining the complexity. Again, my partner always says that, you know, the problem with you architects is that you pick up a problem, simplify the question, and then give a complicated answer. And it should be just the other way around. I mean, you should take the most complex possible question and then give the most simple possible answer. And we tend to operate the other way around. And I just think that we do have a tool that by nature, which is the project, is synthetic. And it, I think it's irresponsible from our side, from the our profession, should be outside that table, because the problem is going to miss this very powerful tool.
And you think that, and I'm trying to get it to answer, because I think it does, one of the questions that this one, is do you think that, that's the sort of way that, I mean, you know, well, there's this question about how we maintain our relevancy during crises, and I think you have answered that. Do you think that's applicable to this coming century as well, the sort of current crises, the environmental and economic crisis?
Well,
certainly the economic, you've addressed that, but...
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, I'm talking about where to start from. I mean, when I said there are enough problems outside, well, by 2030, there are going to be 5 billion people in cities, 2 billion under the line of poverty. I mean, that is mainly migration towards cities. I mean, that means we need to build a 1 million city per week with $10,000 per family for the next 20 years. I mean, with that, who cares about, you know, a comment to the architecture or to the trend, to the previous trend? I mean, I don't care about the personal agendas, because there's enough out there to be solved. And
I would say, then why even care about, why do you, I mean, your work is obviously not engineering. I mean, the way you're saying is the future of architecture is, I mean, if it's possible, and I agree with you, that's a very noble pursuit. But I would say it's not what you do, even. I think what you're saying makes sense. But what you're saying is also, for me, just a baseline of all of architecture. The better architects know how to synthesize all these problems to produce a good building, and then some. And that then some is really what we talk about most of the time. And then, you know, what you're saying is you want to get rid of the and then some when you're talking about this, or whatever, the extra bit outside the...
The then some is going to happen anyway, so that's what doesn't have to become a discourse. That's what I'm saying. That's the handwriting.
But the discourse then is based on what? You think it should all be technical? Like, we're talking about how efficient it is, optimization of architecture.
Yet that doesn't mean technical. I mean, efficiency is not a technical thing. Efficiency is something...
It can be a technical thing.
It can, but it's not only.
Yeah. I would say then what... I mean, it would just be... The education, I would say, would be more towards engineering. Let's say, forget about the... Let's say, it would be like Gropius coming to Harvard in whatever, the 40s, and saying, listen, history, forget about it, guys. Let's just talk about materials. I would say you're like a Gropius kind of figure, which I don't know if that's what you want to be, but the way you're talking to me, it would sound like that. And you would say, they would say, forget about all this stuff. What we need to know is what are the problems, and let's talk about solving these problems, which are, you know, they were cultural, they were structural, material.
But wouldn't you agree that nowadays architects start by saying, well, we were trying to do this and that, and what the starting point is something they're interested in. That's, I mean, take a look at the descriptions of projects, you know, in magazines. They normally start, okay, we're interested in fluid space, we're interested in this type of work, and then, by the way, nobody understands. But I mean, artistic by that. I'm interested in something, and who cares what you're interested in? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if the way you need to solve a problem is through fluid design, fine, do it that way. But that's your own personal problem. I don't care.
I would say, then why do you read autobiographies, or biographies in general, let's say? Because if you're not interested in the kind of...
Because they're real.
...figure, let's say, but the individual...
That's not a fiction. Because this
genius, or the idea of the individual subject or something, because what you're saying to me is like... The idea of desire,
but potentially. But I'm interested in companies' histories as well. I mean, what's required to produce quality? What's required to do better? I mean, it could be a person, because you can't run in. But Formula One, it's about a team. I'm very much interested in what you have to do with tires to gain 1 point of a second.
This fantastic. It wasn't your interest in the team when you were talking about. Although it was, you were talking about just this.
Yeah, but it could talk. But it could talk about
the motor kind of going funny or something. You know what I mean? It was like this genius that runs a team and how the genius can sense things at a level that most people can't. It was sort of a John Henry tale to me also. It's like the man versus the machine and battling it out, and the man actually maybe winning, but maybe in the end gets exploded by the machine itself or dies, you know? So it's a sort of wonderful story, but it seems like it's also at odds with this idea that we would wipe out, let's say, individual desire, which I have... I don't know what to do with it. I also have problems with it, I mean, to be honest. Design is gross at a certain level when you see it as this kind of personal thing. It makes me sick, you know, when you see that. But at the same time, I don't know if we evacuate that. I also think that's a problem. So we're caught in this situation that I don't know.
But I've been systematically during this interview been saying that I'm not taking that part out. But if I have to keep some taste, some desire, some that type of aspect in the thing, it's because either it's the client saying to you, or if it's mine, I don't make it become a discourse. It's going to be there. I'm going to operate that way.
Yeah.
I'm not going to make it explicit to the client to claim, well, give me some space because I want to do my handwriting here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm not saying. It's going to be there. It's part of the problem.
Yeah.
It doesn't belong to the discourse.
Why even show sketches? I would say, why even show the sketches?
I'm trying to make as transparent as possible the process that takes you from A to B. If to start with, I have to describe all the terms of the problem. The first approach comes this way. The second approach, I mean, I would like to show all the versions that we went through and why it was changing. But there's not that interesting, not that people would like to follow that. But I'm trying to make as explicit as possible that while going from A to B had reasons.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about it. I do like your work a lot, by the way. The conversation is almost different than the work for me, in a way, which is interesting and difficult at a certain level. But the work, like... Let's talk about even design and architecture school, because if we're talking about architecture and you're designing an architecture school, you must be thinking even a little bit about this. And when you're describing it, it seems to me there is an interest in the studio, right? And the studio as a kind of the studio as this. When your description of it, that the studio, there's a generosity in a studio which is necessary for an architecture school to work, right? And I'm just wondering, what do you think? How would the client or how did the client or the problem affect this architecture school for you? This would be a moment when you would be very self-conscious, I think, because your client is architects potentially, right?
Yeah, but you know, when you're giving 3 months of time to design and build and $100 per square meter, do you think there's space for thinking? I mean, you have to react.
I think there's always time for thinking. I mean, I think even if it's blink or whatever, you're talking about you're interested in this kind of blink kind of phenomenon where you think in a split second.
Yeah.
And the thing I like about architecture actually, which is interesting, I would even be saying this, is actually how slow it is. Like even given all this time, it's a lot of time compared to some other things. Like architecture is inherently something that you have to look at for a long, prolonged period of time, unlike many other disciplines. You keep looking at for years sometimes, you know, the same problem, the same project. And there's something in the slowness of it that I think is actually incredibly powerful and positive.
So if talking about the architecture school, let's talk about all the specific data that we were trying to deal with. Constraints, 3 months of time for everything, design and construction.
Yeah.
So. Conclusion, you can't do wet operations. I mean, anything that requires water won't be ready in 3 months. Everything has to be dry. It's assembling. So, talking about panels, not bricks, for example.
Yeah.
Then $100 per square meter, that means how many materials out there cost that much? And you will find that your list narrows down to one or two. or two, not because otherwise it's not choice. There were maybe one or two still in panels. Then there was some requirements regarding environmental performance. So zinc plus an injection of polyurethane was the panel. Yeah. That could be mounted because it's light by two people, and we could have many teams of people mounting this simultaneously. So that one was
is zinc cheap there versus like galvanized steel or something, or is zinc?
Yeah, zinc is 4 millimeters.
Yeah.
So it's like this. Yeah. It's the one used for publicity on highways. So you know you can achieve huge surfaces relatively cheap because publicity is going to be there just for a while. So the same material used on highways, but then you see in highways it's like
corrugated.
Like this with a texture. But we didn't want that because it's failing, so we injected this with the panel using the refrigerator technology. We went actually to the guy that was because the guy was trying to work with us for social housing, and he thought he had a material that was efficient for social housing, that was cheap. And he said, you know, I have a refrigerator company, I want to move towards housing. In the end it didn't work, but we used the material for the building. So that was part of the aspect, which is, let's say, technical, economical. On the other hand, we had an existing building, an old adobe building in front of us. How can you engage with that? What's the best language? I mean, and we thought that the reflective surface of the zinc, and you see in the picture, it captures pretty much every color around, and actually the color of the sky. So
usually it gets darker than this, though. It's not so shiny zinc. I mean, this is a new photo, but usually the patina is
in it's still
nice
today, if I show photographs from today, it still happens. And what does, and we've learned that you know, with zinc, we do all the roofing. And whenever you have the problem, if you have a wall and have to do the zinc on top like that, always the question is, okay, what's the color of that piece? If you leave it just like that, it normally takes the color of the sky. So knowing that from what we've built in other places, we said, well, leave the zinc the color it is, because it will take the color of the sky. And actually, if you go inside this kind of disappears in the corner of the eye. So there was a context problem that is, let's say, cultural. I mean, that question is not a technical, scientific question. I mean, context is a cultural kind of problem. And we said, okay, neutral geometry, so 90 degrees, and no color, so that the material itself can reflect the colors outside. And it's not that it disappears. But if you don't want to pay attention to it, it's fine. I mean, no one single form of the building. It's well, all the photographs are taken
to where it looks really good. I mean, it doesn't look
Michael
like...
Michael Meredith makes face.
Yeah, I just think there's something, like, again, like, all the work is so iconic. There's a sort of simplicity, but the simplicity also, like, of these bar buildings, which is kind of a typical... Usually, you tweak the bar a little bit or something like this. It's floating off, which even makes it more iconic, almost, let's say, off the ground. And... it produces a very clear, I think, powerful. Maybe it's the photos again, the effect of photography. But it produces.
Is by chance that the photograph of the existing building that we covered?
No, I'm looking at like the long.
Okay, there's a. I wish I could bring the book. I mean, the existing building, the old building from the 90s, it was full of design. What I mean by capture your eye is that. It had so many geometry that you have to, so many lines. If I do a sketch of it, it required like 100 lines. This one can't be done with 10 lines. That means that your eye, if you don't want to, you don't pay attention to it. But if you want, then the object has to resist that careful attention. I'm going to talk about that later. But there was a second aspect that was context in the building. There was a third aspect, which was program.
We're running out of space.
We've got about 30 minutes left. I just wanted to warn you.
Fine. There was a problem that, you know, the origin of the project is the school said, you know, students are not remaining in school. I mean, they're working at home.
Yeah, I read that. That was interesting. Studio.
And why was that? Well, because when I started, we had a table and we were drawing.
Yeah,
today, they do have computers. And they don't leave their computers in a big room. Security was a big issue. So we thought that by making the size of the room smaller, then you can share a log between 5, not between 20, between 5. And that meant that we subdivided the existing rooms into smaller tubes that then had very little light in the end, that for, you know, drawing was a problem, but today it's fine. I mean, avoiding reflections is what you're looking for. So having a more darker environment, it's fine. What's the problem with, you know, compressing the size of the room? That there's not space for pinning up for the reviews. So in between the old articulated form of the building and the new envelope that was straight, we created a gap that was filled, and there the reviews take place. So we were trying to answer with one single move to program, to context, and to budget, and to time. And that pretty much explains the operation of the building. And of course, there's a degree of freedom.
I think, what would you say is your most important project? Like, what was your most significant project? That's not one of these questions I'm here, but I'm interested too. And like, when you look at your body of work so far, as an older architect, what do you think, like, what was a pivotal project for you? Was it Elemental? Was it an early institutional project? Was it that house, the first house? What, you know, what was the...
Can you
figure it out?
I can't say.
Yeah. What about most challenging?
Can't say.
All pretty tough. Okay, so what about... The one thing that is also interesting, and I'm sure Praxis readers will want to know, is the Pritzker thing. Like, you're the young, you're an architect on the Pritzkers. I think you're sort of young to be on the Pritzker. Whether or not, you know, we want to talk about that again. But like, let's say you're on the Pritzker committee this year. You give it to Zumthorpe. What is that process like? What does that mean for you to be involved in it? Why would you want to be involved in it, even? Like if you're thinking about you're interested more so in building and these kind of problems, why be on the jury for Pritzker?
Because, you know, I just found out, didn't know at the beginning, that, you know, the...
How do you become a Pritzker?
Huh?
How do you become a Pritzker juror? Anyways, all these things I'm curious about.
Yeah, well, yeah. I got a phone call. But, I found out last week that in a regular month, the Pritzker website gets 4 million visits. I mean, even though you don't know the number, you can guess when you're invited that you're going to be able to have an influence in the way things are produced. In the end, what you're saying, okay, look at this guy, it's going to be a referent, not just for architects, which already is a big, big sign that you're sending, a message that you're sending, but also to society. I mean...
More to society, I would even say, than to architects, no?
But architecture students. I mean, do you think an architecture student...
I mean, everyone gets excited. Come on, when we find out, it's like, everyone, like Hillary's like, Zumthorpe just won the Pritzker. You know, it's like, we all get excited about it because everyone wants to know, everyone's betting. They think, oh, is this the year Ito's going to get it? Or is this the year, you know, whatever. You know, everyone's trying to figure out, like...
Yeah, I would say, with my own practice, I have been trying, and again... you said something before about it's very noble from you. I mean, the thing we're doing in Elemental is not that because we are particularly good people. We just think there's a very difficult, tough question that requires a chain of professional quality.
I think you are a good person, actually, for doing it. But that doesn't bother you? I mean,
but that's not the starting point. I mean, we're not claiming on that. This is not volunteer. Where this is
ethical
a whole
dimension. Like, your whole argument to me is also a very ethical argument. Like, the service argument is a moral.
It is, but
argument.
It's not enough. Yeah. And we're more focused on the difficulty of the question than on the, let's say, humanitarian aspect of this thing.
Yeah.
What I want to say by that is that while entering in Elemental, there's also a strategic thought in the sense that, okay, if I'm going to spend energy, joules, you know, of my body, or, you know, seconds, or heartbeats, I mean, why don't we go into a place where it's going to produce more impact? I mean, And not just because of the amount of housing needed when Elemental began, but also because there's less people thinking about that. So maybe if you got to biology, or there are so many brilliant minds out there that the improvements are already happening. There are some places where not that many people are out there trying to produce improvements. So it's more strategic and efficient to try to hit that thing. If by doing that, you also produce an improvement of quality of life for people that have been systematically neglected, fine. But this requires knowledge and requires a certain strategy of going into a void, let's say. The goal in the end is, why don't we try to produce the biggest possible impact in a field? And that's why we went into that. Mm-hmm. I would say that once you're invited to the Pritzker Prize, it's another way to create I don't know the term in English. A literal translation from Spanish would be a resonance box. I mean, when you create something amplifies your voice.
What's the word in Spanish?
Caja de resonancia. It's a loudspeaker, let's say. I mean, but it's more than a loudspeaker. It's not by talking louder. It's by
reverberation.
Yeah. And so that's why in Elemental, media has been so important, trying to find the language that politicians and media can understand so that we can have an impact on society, not just on architecture. And the Pritzker, I would say, has that type of chance, at least. It's potentially, there's another way to create an impact indirectly. I mean, the relationship effort and result, it's almost perfect. I mean, compared to the result you might get, you have to invest very little compared to what you have to do by doing your own projects. And I think they're pretty much complement themselves with the work we do at the office. And so when I got called, of course, you think that it's a challenge and it's a privilege. I mean, in the end, it's a noble prize. I mean, who would deny that? And once inside, not that it's guaranteed, but at least you have the chance to be part of the ongoing debate of where the profession should move. I mean, it's not being said that once inside, the decisions are going to be... What I do like about Zumthor's name in this case, in a way, arrived late. I mean, I entered this in January of this year, and the previous year, always a conversation taking place.
Well, you know, just when you go to the buildings, you fly and go look at them.
Yeah.
That's great. I think that's important.
Yeah, that's one of the conditions, because it's not that much money. I mean,
that's what you got to do.
So the question is about the rigor of the jury. I mean, you can't choose an architect if you haven't been in the work. At least members of the jury haven't been in person in the work. So that requires from us, if it's not official, to be visiting work of people that you think might be eligible for the prize. And again, with the message you're able to send while choosing somebody, or what's missing. I mean,
what's the message with Zumthor, do you think? What's the message that you send?
I would say that that you can succeed. I mean, and can achieve quality by being concentrated on something, no matter what it is, and no matter even if I agree by doing that. In this case, it's construction and place. I mean, all his work is a concentrated act, an act of intensification more than of expansion, let's say. And I would say that, okay, let's take something and stick to this. It's something that...
It's not about commercial success or something like this, you're saying.
Even though he might have some, and it's fine that he gets one, he's more concentrated in intensifying what he's doing. I also like that
in this thing of, like you were saying, I don't know if he would be like the team person. Like, I think he really tries to set up where the team is like him and maybe a couple other people, and he's really in there.
And maybe that's what's but I would say one thing at a time. Yeah. I mean, compared to the trend and the history of Pritzker's, then this is a contained architect. This is a very austere architect, even though his architecture is very sophisticated and expensive architecture. And we're not talking about poverty here. Yeah. But he's a contained architect. He would use the means that are the case for the thing he's doing, not because they're just available. I mean, he chooses few materials, few forms, few geometries, but so the question of being contained in the choices is something that I am. And then I think he might be too local. One would like, architects doing be more engaged in the in problems that are more contaminated. I mean, that you're less safe, let's say, in the choices of what you do. But again, I would say one thing at a time. I think it might. A change, and actually the jury began by a kind of premise, and you have to take into consideration what this happened was Obama's inauguration. Change was in the air. I mean, that was pretty much, I mean, we were there. Obama
was... So towards the Obama of architecture?
No. I don't think so. No. But definitely there was a mood in the air that things had to change. There was the presidential inauguration in the U.S., but there were also all the crises going around. I mean, you can't keep on giving the prize the same way it was being given.
But he's not a surprise out of the blue candidate necessarily, is he? Do you think he was kind of a shock?
Not for architects, but take a look at what New York Times reported and the Chicago Tribune and Los Angeles.
What they say?
A complete unknown wins the Pritzker.
A complete unknown.
That's pretty much the reaction of the broader audience. I mean, a very an unknown architect in Switzerland wins. I mean, not the typical name, and not the for the media.
Do you think they would know any of the people there? Like, they would know Ido. They wouldn't know any of the people on the list. I mean, whoever. I don't even know who the list was. But
you think that Peter Eisenman wouldn't be known,
Peter Eisenman more obscure than Zumthor, even. I would imagine.
I wouldn't say so. I mean,
you think he's.
I mean, he's trying to get involved in many big projects.
Project, and I mean, he's published all over. Okay. I mean, and building all over the place. There's Berlin Memorial.
To me, seems like he's more even an academic. Like, I would say Zumthor is less of an academic.
Yeah, fair enough.
In a way, I feel like an academic.
But he's trying to be. But Heisenman is trying to be famous, trying to be on the media. I mean, goes to Barcelona and wears the Barcelona soccer team shirt to appear on the newspaper. I mean, he's doing all he possibly can for that. For that.
For
marketing.
Do you think Zumthor is solving problems?
I hope so. I would guess. But what do you think? Yeah.
I mean, now being on the,
I would say he's creating situations that are appropriate for the question he's asked. I mean, for example, in the baths, the thermal baths and valves. But I think it's amazing. Besides, of course, the use of stone and everything. That at least when I saw it for the first time in a magazine, I said, what the hell is this guy looking at? I mean, the way he was using stone was a complete different thing from what you saw in magazines. I mean, but what I think it's more amazing about that work is that, you can't jump into the water. I mean, you always enter the water walking. There are stairs. You enter walking.
Slow.
And there's always a stair to enter the water.
Yeah.
That means that this guy understood that while going to a bath, either you're old or you're sick, and of course there are children and everything, but what you're doing there is to go to the water to take energy from it, not to spend energy like in a swimming pool.
Yeah.
It's not a sport. It's a different thing.
Yeah.
Or a curating kind of thing. So to have been able to understand that you enter the water walking slowly and not jumping into the water is to have understood the very nature of what you were creating, the situation you need to create. Is that a problem solving? I mean, I don't know, but it's appropriate and it's pertinent.
I want to go back to the Walter Gropius thing, because I would say, do you think that when you see a Walter Gropius building, do you go, this is awesome? Or do you go, do you think of like this kind of thing, because like, let's say he would very much put architecture in the problem-solving category. And I would just be curious, like, what your, as someone now who judges architecture, it's the same kind of thing. Are you judging it on these criteria, or do you judge it on, let's say...
You know, to be honest, I do not know very much Gropius architecture. I mean, so I couldn't say... I don't think I've been in any Gropius building to be able to say.
Yeah.
So,
but then you didn't even know it, but yeah.
Yeah, could be. Yeah. No, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's sort of... I mean, it's interesting. It's very much in the modernist trajectory, though, this kind of...
Let me go back to one... I said I wanted to say something regarding the... being in the corner of the eye or being in the center of the attention. One of the things that I learned from Fernando Perez, who was my professor at the beginning, is that he always explained architecture as being simultaneously a mirror and a cloak. You know, a mirror in the sense that it's a cultural object that you produce, that you pay attention to, and actually that object has to resist that careful look to the point to reflect a society, yeah, a sensibility, a moment in time, history, yeah, even the author. But it's an optic... I mean, if we talk about this cup of coffee, I mean, the thinness of the material talks about a certain capacity to produce ceramics in this width, and then maybe the sensibility of this is more... It's a simple line, maybe different from a cup of 100 years ago. So you can talk about this object, eventually not that much more than what I've talked right now. There might be other cups that you can talk for hours. I mean, so it's an object that you design to resist that attention and that careful look simultaneously.
But if you're an aficionado of, let's say, of coffee cups or design, you could say, you look at this and you would say, you could compare it to Jasper Morrison's cup, or you could compare it to whatever. You could go through the kind of, I mean, this is a crappy IKEA cup, honestly. But if you could look at it and compare it to a whole taxonomy of other cups, I'm sure, if you really care about it.
Well, and you could even talk about the performance criteria of it. Is its shape make you appreciate the aroma of the coffee?
Or is it stable? Does it sound when I move the table? And many, many things that if you want to judge it, it has to receive that judgment. On the other hand, this is a cloak in the sense that you don't have to pay attention to it at all to be able to have the cup of coffee and have this conversation. So you do like this and don't even pay attention. If it was too design, let's say, or too uncomfortable, I mean, if you pay attention, great, it talks a lot, but you can't even hold it in your hand because it's so complicated that it can't disappear in the corner of the eye. So the cloak has to be able to be designed in such a way that you don't pay attention to it at all. And so Fernando Perez uses the example of a window to explain a good design. I mean, on the one hand, a window, it's a word of an architectural language. I mean, if you want to judge, even if it's, let's say, not arty, but it has some art.
You know what's interesting is, though, the window is always the thing that people, how they describe painting, too. But, I mean, like, that's the classic, it's a weird thing, because if somebody who, like, say, not interested in art, but the window, architecture as a window is usually art historians, or there's a whole discourse in art around even the mirror, let's say in painting, the mirror and the window. And this is a whole unbelievable trajectory that I think is almost...
And the thing is that he said that, like, a window is an object that you pay attention to, the proportion, the height, it talks about certain technical capacities because, you know, the lintel that you're able to do, depends on techniques. And so you can build an entire discourse on the window simultaneously. The ultimate purpose of the window is not pay attention to it at all, to let view, air, and light to come in. So he always says... Let me finish. But the thing is that he said that a good architectural project is always both things at the same time. I mean, If you pay attention to it, it's a great cultural object. But simultaneously, it has to be able to disappear in the corner of the eye to let you live your life, you know.
I would disagree. I would say that architecture, this is always this thing.
I'm not trying to convince you. I believe that, so feel free to disagree. I don't mind if you disagree.
I think architecture, though, would be, maybe it's not in the place for me to disagree, it's your interview, but I would say, you know, architecture is always in a, the difference between architecture and building, let's say just building, is one of attention and duration of attention. So let's say building can exist and you just look through it and it's just there. And architecture is something that in which people will go to it, look at it, and give prizes for it. So and build the discourses around it. And I think your this idea of it's the problem I always had with Walter Benjamin, that architecture is received in a state of distraction or whatever it is. And I never believe that. I think architecture inherently
that's incomplete. And I agree with that. I think that to be falsely modest that they're saying, you know, pure service. I'm that's why systematically through this, I've been trying to say no, I'm not saying that. But if the price you have to pay to be the architectural object is that it can't disappear in the corner of the eye, then something's wrong. Pure service is necessary but not enough. The other thing, if it can't disappear in the corner, and you can't actually use it normally, distractedly, then something's missing.
I agree.
You know, I think that's a great place to end, but if there are any questions, that actually I think would be a fantastic sort of closing portion to it. So, but if there's anything that we missed in the back.
We didn't really follow the.
You know, I took the picture of the coffee cup because I realized that the ones we used at Meaton and Eric's were these things that were formed to your hand with three things. They were sort of cylinders that were depressed on one side. And actually, since we can't take the pictures of the interviews, maybe we have the pictures of all the coffee cups. We can go retroactively take the photos of the coffee cups.
I wish we brought our good coffee cups down. We all have,
I think it's a perfect example. Exactly. And I think Meijin's, because it's this thing that's shaped to the... And it was something I really noticed as I was using it, although it worked very well.
Yeah, it's ultimately, so, which is interesting. I mean, I'm not interested... The same kind of thing is, like, almost on the verge of generic. I mean, the weird thing is I agree with you, but I just don't... I think you're taking an extreme... extreme thing that makes me a little bit nervous. It doesn't matter.
But we should go back and retroactively photograph the coffee cups and their locations. So.
That's a good idea. We could set this up and just pretend we're...
I got this one, but the one at the GSD.
We have paper coffee cups.
I'm sure you did. Great.
It was paper.
You can take the picture of the paper one on your desk or something. Yeah. Anyway, so is there anything that we... Because we are going to run out of tape time, is my concern.
I think it's good. Our research...
Yeah, what about the
Do you do after, if you have no more projects, what do you do? What's research mean? Or is it architecture dead at that point, I would guess? That would be a question.
What do you mean by no more projects?
Say you have no more, the economy collapses, you can't get a client.
No more projects.
What do you do at that point? Do you just decide to start a bar again or something like this? Or do you start making up projects?
Well, half of the projects we have at the office do not come from a client that came to the office. I mean, maybe that's, a merit of my partner. Being a transport engineer, there's a system in the Ministry of Public Works in Chile that if you come up with an idea and it becomes rated as public interest, then you get an advantage of 3-5% in the public bids that then are afterwards done. So we said, there's a traffic problem in this part of the city. Let's propose a new bridge or a train or a highway. And we have to have capital and some financing. And the Chilean Oil Company, who is partner of the Elemental, provides us so that we can invest a couple of months to do the studies and to do the project. Once we get that declaration of public interest, then we get not only, even if we don't win, because you can sell your part or you can partner with, let's say, a consortium to be part of the business. Even if you don't win, you are required to be paid back all the money you invested in studies. And that could be $500,000 in studies. I mean, the environmental studies and traffic studies and all that type of thing. So we're not waiting for work to come, really, in the office, at least in important part of it. But, you know, this time, we're just moving to a new office because we need to grow. I mean,
how big is it? How big is your office?
We're about 15 moving to 20.
That's awesome.
And we've never had more work than today, and particularly if we're also creating a new company for prefabrication for the housing. And if that happens, I mean, the more crisis there is,
the better
yeah. Because the housing deficit is even more improving. Actually, mm-hmm. we've got never more building companies, big ones, coming to the bids of housing projects than today. So quality is improving because all the companies, in order not to fire their employees, go into social housing, which is a non-elastic demand. I mean, you don't wait for the market. You have a fund approved by the Congress per year that has to be spent anyway. And that's pretty much very clear in every big company radar. I mean, everybody's moving into infrastructure, into yeah. public housing, because that's the way to resist the crisis. So, since elemental works with public funds and with scarcity and with deficits, I mean, the more crisis, the more work there's going to be. At least for that part of the office. And financial, I mean, if this was a broker, let's say we are diversified. I mean, we have infrastructural projects, we have public space, housing, and the conventional architecture. So I don't think that it's going to... Well, it can always happen, of course. You know, all of your building collapses all of a sudden, and everybody realizes that you're a very bad architect, and that's it. But until now, it's moving the other way around.
What about number one?
Oh, who are the peer? Your that's a good one. I don't know why I skipped over that. I thought we tried to talk about that. Who are your peers? Who you consider to be part of your generation? Who are your? Like when you say, "Hey man, I'm working on this new," or whatever. You're calling people up and talking about your projects. Who are these people?
Or and then also I think the corollary is how do you see your work in relation to the other?
Yeah, other people
in this issue.
Who are all the people? Do you know who all the people are? Yeah.
You guys, Spina, Marcelo Spina,
Work AC,
Mimi and Eric, of course. Mijin and Eric, Hi Architects.
Far? Are they? No, I sure
well, yeah, you know that's on the.
Yeah. Aranda Lash.
We're working it. Yeah, Aranda Lash. I'm not sure where the Far is going to end up in it. They were sort of the one that we were the least convinced about, and then the timing isn't working out very well.
Okay, the Living.
But the Living.
So you're not going to have 11?
No, the AR is going to be 11.
Yes.
Like.
Yes.
Means they're not in it. But okay, so it's a. You kind of get the.
Yeah.
Picture probably.
You know.
I
mentioned some guys working in South America that I think are closer to our context, like Benitez in Paraguay, Bucci in Brazil.
Productora in Mexico City.
In Mexico, yeah. So yes, with them I would say there's a kind of dialogue of, even though the architectures do not look alike, I feel some proximity with the way they produce their answers and the means that they have to produce their answers.
But you think, like, let's say, of the American scene, as someone looking from the outside, because most of the people from this are American.
North
American.
Three of 11 who aren't.
Yeah, but well, let's say it's a North American publication, even or whatever you call it.
You know, if you go to the office, you will find out that we are not subscribed to any magazine at all. Unless I don't know what's going on really. If somebody in the office,
you're on the Pritzker jury.
No, from January on. Before that.
So now you'll know what's going on.
I will have to.
Yeah.
I mean, but not yet. But I was pretty much. I mean, and I really always appreciated that about Chile. I mean, I'm not going against the current. I mean, in Chile, you're far away enough so that things that arrive do have to have a reason to arrive. And I'm protected by distance, and I'm very much conscious about that, and I really like that.
You taught at Harvard though for many years.
Yeah,
you were the epicenter of the American Northeast.
But again, when that stopped in 2004, I never again took a look at a magazine. I happened to be at Harvard exhibitions where, and the world was coming to you. I mean, without moving, you had the world in front of you. Mm-hmm. Once you move out of there, the world is not coming to Chile. So,
and you shared an office with a practice editor.
Yeah. So I really don't know very much about what's going on in the scene.
It probably hasn't changed even that. I mean, the people that are in this issue probably were there in 2000 and...
Could be, but of the names you mentioned, I don't know.
I
can't connect work with the name.
Yeah.
But all of them were part of Ordos, too, which is interesting.
Yeah, all of them are part of Ordos.
You know what what tends to happen to me? Whenever there's a magazine, if there's a rendering,
yeah.
I don't look at it. I mean, I'm not...
You're not interested in the renderings at all?
No. So if it's not built, doesn't count.
That's interesting. It's not built, it doesn't count. That wipes out a whole bunch of really nice projects, like, for me. Like, if you look at even like Cons, like Dominican Sister, the convent, I love that plan. You can't get to a lot of built work without going through that plan, even, or things like this, or even...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, I'm saying that every now and then you see a project here that influences you, but the things you look at, I mean, the ones that you want to study, the ones you want to understand... The one that you want to learn from, or the one you want to escape from, are the ones that are built. I mean, otherwise, I mean, not complex enough. I mean, because in the rendering, even though it might be a very complex issue, I mean, it's not complex enough. It's just the author and the tool. All the complexity coming into them, I mean, a client not wanting it, you know, a politician not allowing it to be built, you know, neighbors protesting, all that contamination that shaped things is not in there. So
but all that stuff, though, still goes to, in the end, it has to go to the architect and the tool, like you're talking about. Like, all those influences, I would say, is like, in the end, architects produce representations of things that get built. You have to produce drawings, someone else builds it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a distance, actually, between... That's the difference between...
Sure, but if I take a look at my own projects, I mean, from the first image that I produced to what is in the end, they're so completely different.
Sure.
And of course, at the beginning, they looked all cool. I mean, then they have to struggle and negotiate and okay, give up things, okay, but this is going to get done. And all that process that, you know, it's... the way your face is formed with happiness and sadness and everything, and I like better that.
Do you go to every meeting in your office? Like, let's say for projects,
pretty much.
If this thing of like the importance of the struggle, so you're at every meeting.
Yes, pretty much.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a point when. If you recognize when you become so successful, let's say, which seems like the case in like a few years, I'm sure you'll probably grow to 50 people or something. If there's a point when you have to say, hold on, I'm losing touch with the project.
I think that's the worst thing that can happen to somebody. That you become so, let's say, famous or something, then you're allowed to do whatever you want. Then you're just competing with yourself, which is doesn't take the best out of you. The good thing is that because of the nature of part of the projects we do, not all of them, but part of the projects we do, that will never happen. Mm-hmm. Let's say while doing a highway. I mean,
but once you start doing projects, let's say in other countries, it's going to get hard, man. I would imagine, like Vitra, maybe you have to, like how you even can go to all the meetings and still, do you still teach?
No.
Okay. And still go to other projects and fly. I mean, at a certain point, it's just going to become, I would imagine. Like.
And that's why I think one has to choose. I mean, not for just the work, for reasons, for family reasons. I mean, I can't go out of Chile leaving the family alone. So you have to pick up very carefully the projects that you're going to work and on, because it means that you're going to have to go out. And Vitra, for example, but that's a slow project, for example. But just by chance, not that I asked that to be that way. But in the Texas project, I had to come regularly to explain to a committee why we were doing every single thing we did, from the color of the doors to, you know, the general portee of the project. And
do you think that process makes it better? Or, let's say?
If you can resist, yes. I mean, you have to have nerves. I mean, it gets irritating to a point, because sometimes you arrive to the part of the problem that you can't talk about. I mean, actually, there were a couple of meetings in the Texas project where I said, you know what? I think it should be done this way because it looks better, because I think so. And then the committee said, yeah, okay, we're fine with that.
That's good. That's
but fair. But before arriving to that point, we had to prove and make tests. If we do it this way, if we do it that way, the disalignment, the non-alignment, the proportion of the window, the color of the door. I mean, how many things can you explain? I mean, I'm okay to explain general gestures like the footprint, the massive, the height, the how many entrances you're going to have. But then there are other things that are not that important in the end. I mean, it's just taste. So, at a certain point, I think you have to stop, and I think it's going to be a question of choice. But coming back to the if you lose the touch with the situation, I think I'm a little bit protected from that because of the nature of some projects we do. I mean, some projects are complex enough. I mean, there are projects in Chile that have, you know, maybe the most brilliant urbanist that there is out there coming, and he's not respected in any way. So if he's not respected, that means fine. I will have to fight for my points of view, because for a highway, for a public space, I mean, which is billions of dollars, I mean, nobody will hire you because of your famous. I mean, you're going to be accountable for every single move you do, which is fine. Then there's the families. I mean, that do not even know who you are. I mean, you're just an architect that went to the university, and because of that, you know things that they don't. But beyond that, they don't care.
I think it would hurt you, even, probably. At a certain level, being an academic can hurt you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
we've got like 4 minutes.
It's okay. I'm not even talking for the tape.
Yeah,
anymore.
Yeah,
I
know.
We're just talking.
Yeah, and
we have to do this more often, huh?
Yes, good.
But, and then, yeah, I think if you have good clients like Feldbaum in Vidra, he makes the right question at the right time, will get the designs that you do, and get the mood of the project, the character of the project, which are things that are so difficult to talk about. He would say, you know, I would like to have a more happy building.
Cool.
How do you, I mean, it's
that's
fantastic.
Actually interesting. That's an actually interesting conversation, I would think, actually. That's not such an easily quantifiable problem where you start to put calculations to it.
But you put it on the table explicitly. Yeah. I mean, yeah. you can't...
I love those problems are probably for me more...
Yeah, use encouraging materials. Do a direct building. He didn't say simple, economic, cheap.
Yeah.
No, he did direct. I think that those type of questions are great, and again, are part of the equation. I mean, it's not an objective way out of it.
Yeah.
But somehow, it's like time, you know? You know when things are direct and when they are not. I mean, it's like time. I mean, we all know what it is. Ask me to define it, I'm in deep trouble.
Yeah.
But we know what it is. I mean, direct, we know what it is. Happy, we know what it is.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, sure.
More or less,
yeah. You know, sad, you know what it is.
Jeff says we should. Jeff Gittman says we should do an issue of Praxis called Happy. Yeah, he wants to see an issue. We deal with the happy in architecture.
Who?
Jeff Gittman.
In a way, that would be deeply problematic for all of us. I think
absolutely.
The unquantifiable.
I think that it exists and it belongs to the things that you can experience, but you can't do them. I mean, you go there and it is there. I mean, once you begin a discussion about it, I think you're in deep, deep
trouble. Absolutely.
I mean,
but I think that's an interesting trouble. I think that there are some people who do talk about it and it always comes across as naive and simplistic or something. But I also think sometimes, I think any time you talk about architecture, it can be received as, even when you talk about, let's say, function, it can be naive and simplistic because architecture is what's interesting about it is it's extremely complex, you know?
It's an extremely complex thing. And I don't even think you can hold the whole thing in your head at once, a building. There's too many things going on.
Yeah.
And so, anyways. I think this stuff
is awesome. I don't know if I...
I think this was great.